the Honourable Reverend Dr. Lynn Arnold. Probably needs no introduction to many of us in this room. A former Premier of South Australia, Ambassador for Reconciliation SA, and an ordained minister in the Anglican Diocese of Adelaide, Reverend Arnold holds a PhD in sociolinguistics from the University of Adelaide and chairs the advisory group at the University of South Australia's Research Centre on Languages and Culture. He has served as the CEO of Anglicare and of World Vision. In this oration, the Honourable the Reverend Dr. Lynn Arnold will explore the importance of language to Aboriginal cultural identities. Welcome to the stage, please, the Honourable Reverend Dr. Lynn Arnold AO.
Nadlu tampendi, ganamayuna, yetamatanya, wamataranyako. Ganamayunako, yotako, taikaringa, tawila. Panako tapa poruna, bulto, yalchakuma, nadlu. Panadlu waru, terlatina, mankuriadlu. Nadlu tampendi, ramanjeri, naranjeri, anangu, adnamatna, naranga, mbangala. Mayuna kuma, la yalara. Mani nabudni, yainchen barendi, gana yatanga, bilyanina, yatanga. With respect to Kaurna speakers here present, particularly Uncle Lewis, who has given me the go-ahead to be able to say these words, even if I don't pronounce them properly. With respect to Kaurna speakers here present, and with the approval, as I've said, of Uncle Lewis and others, I've previously been given to say, we acknowledge the Kaurna people and their spiritual relationship with the land, and as the traditional custodians of the Adelaide region. We acknowledge their living culture, heritage, and beliefs. We also acknowledge the Naranjeri, Ramanjeri, Anangu, Adnamatna, Naranga and Mangala people here today and welcome them to this meeting on Kaurna land. May we walk together in harmony in a spirit of reconciliation. Well, thank you very much for this invitation to give this 10th Lower Tjuru Donoghue Oration. It is a moment of exceeding pride for me that I was asked, Lower Tjuru, to give this oration in your name. It was January the 26th in Adelaide this year. It's Australia Day. We speak English in Australia. So said some unknown woman to Elizabeth Close, who at this Adelaide ceremony had been speaking to her young daughter in Pitjantjatjara. Ironically, it was on that same day that atop Sydney Harbour Bridge, Jessica Mowboy sang our national anthem in English, and then in what some in the press referred to as an Aboriginal dialect, and the SBS referred to as a medley of local Sydney dialects, but which was, in fact, as reported by National Indigenous Television, constructed from a range of Eora dialects. 3 weeks later, Northern Territory MP and Government Minister Bess Nungaraya Price, a speaker of five languages, was denied permission to speak in her first language, Walpuri. The Speaker saying, should a member use a language other than English without leave of the Assembly, it will be ruled disorderly, and a member will be required to withdraw the words. Tellingly, Bess Close said, I feel that I cannot effectively represent my electorate without using my first language, Walpuri. The Speaker, for her part, writing about the issue and the obvious potential solution of providing for interpreting services in such instances, stated, there is a standing order, number 245, which applies to prohibit interpreters and translators on the floor of the Assembly during proceedings. Coincidentally, it had been about this time of these two incidents that I had quite separately been speaking with Lower Tjuru about what I might choose for my topic tonight. I said that I was keen to speak on the subject of Australia's first languages, the situation they had faced over time since colonial settlement, and then look at both the challenges and opportunities ahead for those that are still being spoken or capable of being revived or awakened, as Professor Gillard Zuckerman says. I was very appreciative, Lower Tjuru, that you were not only agreeable to my speaking on this subject, but felt that it was an important one to raise. At the outset, I must point out that though my doctorate is in sociolinguistics and focused on language and identity, I cannot pretend to deep knowledge of the sociolinguistic and linguistic complexities that apply to Australia's first languages. Furthermore, I am very much aware that I am speaking tonight very much in the shadow of giants in that field, both Aboriginal and not. people such as Dr. Kawenu Lewis Yulaburka O'Brien. You move chairs. Dr. Napadla Alicia Waltra Rigney, Wallara Rigney, Jack Kanya Buckskin, Georgina Yambo Williams, Professor Lester Irabini Rigney, Dr. Rob Amory, and Professor Gillard Zuckerman, amongst many others. But I have timorously stepped into this space because of my own love of the subject of language and identity, and in the face of languages living in environments where they are dominated by others. The universal questions and methodologies that may at least be considered to enable those languages not only to survive, but to thrive. In my doctoral thesis, I drew a number of conclusions that were all based upon the study of the language known as Asturiano, or Bable, spoken in the northern Spanish province of Asturias. For the purposes of tonight's oration, I'll be referring to three broad conclusions. I was going to show three slides in that regard, but they'll be on the speech version that is put on the website tomorrow, so just so you don't have to worry about death by PowerPoint. But in terms of those three broad conclusions I want to relate to, in terms of having them show you how I'm looking at this topic, firstly, at the level of policymaking, a generic approach applying a cookie-cutter, the same policy framework to each language, to each language at risk, would work only occasionally and then purely by happenstance. This is because policy in the area of language promotion needs to take into account a complex interaction of issues that revolve around the status and vitality not only of the language being spoken, but of the very group itself. By status, I refer both to the extrinsic, in other words, the status conferred, and the intrinsic, the self-awareness, the self-consciousness, in terms both of group and language. In terms of vitality, this refers to the degree of dynamism as opposed to a more static state that is evident in both group and language. In the case of the Aboriginal communities in South Australia, and indeed Australia at large, the situation could be described, for example, as reasonably high group status for the Anangu Pitjantjatjara Yankunytjatjara, followed by Kaurna and Ngarrindjeri, through to perhaps, at this stage at least, lower group status for Bangala. On the language status front, there has been more extrinsic recognition over time of Pitjantjatjara than almost any other language in the state, and until recently, almost none for groups such as Bangala. Turning to the dimension of languages spoken, language vitality also varies between these languages. Taking this approach, it can be seen that there are a myriad permutations of the four elements that would create a diversity of need too wide for a single generic policy on language to adequately deal with. Secondly, notwithstanding successful policy making by the policymakers, there is also the issue of implementation that arises out of policy. Here, my thesis proposed that successful implementation of policy necessitates an interactive process that engages both the macro and micro levels. That is to say, both the governance institutions of the wider community, such as government, education department, the legal system, called the macro, and the immediate community itself, namely the micro. The engagement point between these two is the meso level and would be represented by such entities as schools, churches, local police stations, local health facilities, local courts, and the like. These meso-level entities become the key to the degree of genuine interaction that may occur between the macro and the micro. Their roles can be mediating or stymieing. At its best, this approach would echo what is known in development circles as co-design with co-governance, an approach which, again, citing development circles, is often best affected when using such methodologies as appreciative inquiry. A key finding in my thesis is represented in a graphic that I will put on the website. But in this graphic, you will see an attempt to make to map language used by an analysis of the domains where it is used and also the genres in which it's used. Furthermore, to consider such usage in both active and passive modes. In other words, where the individual is either a direct participant or simply a listener or viewer. The premise here is that the further the domains and genres have retreated. The top left-hand corner, which is more personal, such as interaction with family, friends, local community, and in terms of genres, such things as conversation, family legends, tales, folklore, songs, and so on. An underlying premise here is described by the old adage, languages don't die, they simply stop being spoken. And why might they no longer be spoken? The key issue is that individual speakers might have found less and less utility in using the language in question compared to the alternative dominant language in which they live. The solution to such shrinking back of domains and genres is to work intentionally in expanding the areas of each where individual speakers might come to find it worthwhile using their first language in more situations than previously, reducing their dependence on the dominant language in such situations. So it's through those three broad areas of conclusion that I approach this topic tonight. In October 2008, on the occasion of a special event to celebrate the International Year of Languages, I gave an address entitled Breaking Free of the Fear of Babel, a celebration of the linguistic diversity of humanity. And in that speech, I spoke about the fragile state of Australia's first languages. In an attempt to have some comparative understanding of the situation, I consulted the Ethnologue, Languages of the World Dictionary, edited by Ray Gordon. Now, such compendia are always risky to use, and Rob Amory has pointed out to me subsequently some of the limitations of the Ethnologue analysis. But not to mention the somewhat suspect nature of many of the statistics cited for the numbers of speakers and other errors, nevertheless, on the basis of a somewhat messy errors and omissions accepted basis, the book is capable of providing indicative information. So let me tell you what it found. Perusing the entry for Australia, in particular with respect to the 231 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, it found that 11 of them were being spoken by between 1 and 10,000 people. A further 40 were being spoken between 100 and 999, while 80 were being spoken by between 10 and 99 people. The largest individual group of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, 92 of them, were being spoken, according to the Ethnologue statistics, by less than 10 people. However, there was a final and itself a very large group of 88 languages that were listed as being either extinct or nearly extinct. These are alarming figures, made much worse by some of the comparative analysis with the rest of the world. The 92 languages in Australia said to be spoken by less than 10 people represented 45% of all such languages in the world. For the record, again using Ethnologue's figures, it would seem that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, in addition to being 45% of all languages spoken by less than 10 people, made up 23% of languages spoken by less than 100, and 4% less than 999. That was in 2008. In that Olympic year, 2008, it seemed Australia was winning gold, silver, and bronze medals in the race to language extinction. What does the current situation look like using more rigorous statistics? There's another graphic you will see on the website when the speech goes up that talks about the number of people in the community who are using the language within broad areas. And you will see naturally that in the Northern Territory and the northern part of South Australia, relatively high figures. But right around the coast of the east and the west, those figures drop away dramatically. ABS figures have suggested some deterioration. For example, just looking at those aged over 45, the figure of those speaking Indigenous languages has fallen from 16% amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, from 16% in 2001 to 13% in 2006, and then to 11% in 2011. And likewise, similar figures are shown for other age groups. While in 2011 the ABS reported that 16.6% answered they did not speak English or did not speak it well, does this imply that the remainder in those communities were speaking English? The answer is not necessarily. For example, while 10% of those under 15 were reported as speaking an indigenous language, 85% were reported as speaking English. So what about the missing 5%? I don't have specific information on that, other than the speculation that Creole, Yumplatok, and Aboriginal English may have filled the gap. Whether those three modern Aboriginal languages did or did not explain the gap, what the 2011 census did find was that Creole was the most spoken language in Indigenous communities. Furthermore, that Aboriginal English was reportedly spoken by 1,000 at home, with thousands more speaking it in community. Of all languages considered, Aboriginal English, in fact, showed the largest increase. So the statistical evidence has not been promising and could be interpreted to suggest that there may be an inevitability to the ultimate demise of all of Australia's first languages. And unfortunately, there are many who simply see such a prospect of mass language extinction as an indicator of social evolution, a Darwinian linguistic survival of the fittest. In reality, in sociolinguistic terms, language survival or extinction is not a case of survival of the fittest, but survival of the most powerful. Aidan Ridgway, then a senator, said in 2009, "Language is power. Let us have our power." By implication, he was acknowledging that the capacity of Australia's First Nations to have real equality of power and status within the Australian Commonweal would be severely hampered if there was appropriate recognition of Australia's first languages. The earliest days of colonial settlement showed differing power faces to the language communities they encountered. Here in South Australia, in 1841, the then governor of South Australia, George Grey, wrote that upon bringing of commerce to the new colony, the ruder languages disappear successively, and the tongue of England alone is heard around. George Grey obviously hadn't read a report written just 6 months earlier by Matthew Morehouse to the colonial secretary. This is what Morehouse said about these ruder languages. "Seven parts of speech are now clearly recognised. The substantives, the adjectives, pronouns admit of a regular declension, leaving the inflection of the verb the chief field for future research. This division is not altogether unknown. We are in possession of four moods." And he goes on talking about the grammar, but I was more inclined, in fact, to listen to something that Uncle Lewis said. "Language is the beginning of knowing culture. Words help to form the way you think. Language gives your thoughts discipline and order. Our Kaurna language is very specific and has many rules. We have no conjunctions, no and, but more conjugations than Latin." A ruder language indeed. Why should we consider it important to retain as much of Australia's linguistic inheritance as possible? Well, taking a step back to the very purposes of language, language is the repository of a group's stored information about physical and social context, and of the general experience and perceptions of living. How else can the past inform the present? So the incredible linguistic richness that the first colonial settlers encountered in Australia was much more than just a confusing array of languages. It was a rich, purposeful linguistic diversity across the continent's hundreds of nations. Each of those languages represented millennia of evolutionary experience, a repository of information gathered over millennia. The subsequent destruction through neglect and even outright repression of many of those languages saw also the death of a vast amount of knowledge about the country that those languages had contained in their lexicons and their analogical perspectives contained within. As has been noted in the report, Indigenous Kids and Schooling in the Northern Territory, the death of small languages is a tragedy for all human beings in a global sense. This is because ancient wisdom and artistic productions, handed down from generation to generation in stories and songs and poetical dramas or dances, die out. Old, specialized languages of Indigenous groups also have great scientific value. For instance, from a medicinal point of view, the names and uses of medicinal plants may be lost when old people who speak those languages die. These languages provide understandings about climate, food sources, animal migration, and reproduction patterns, and other forms of information about the world around us. The report goes on to make the point, when languages die, a central part of a group's identity changes forever, and it may take generations for new core elements of identity to evolve. What has been done to Australia's first languages since 1788 has been akin to burning the Great Library of Alexandria in terms of knowledge of land, context, and world that has been lost as languages have died. The library is still on fire, with much already destroyed, so the challenge to us as an Australian people is whether we will let that great repository of knowledge continue to burn, or will we douse the fire to save what has not yet been lost and scour the ashes to retrieve what may yet be salvaged. Professor Gillard Zuckerman has suggested that this vast linguistic loss should open up a discussion on the concept of native tongue title, including a debate as to why there should not be compensation for language loss that has occurred. And he cites the ethical reasons for this. The loss of language is more severe than the loss of land. Language death equals loss of cultural autonomy. Language death equals loss of spiritual and intellectual sovereignty. Language death can equal loss of soul. And he repeats the point that I've made before. Language is a repository of ideas, values, and experience. Now that's a contentious proposition, but one that nevertheless raises important points that must be considered. In my strong opinion, the most appropriate compensation for this language loss would be no more or no less than an investment of time, effort, and resources in sustaining those languages still being spoken and in awakening those that Gillard refers to as sleeping beauties. Let me now turn to the issues involved in sustaining presently spoken languages and awaking the sleeping beauties. Firstly, what is needed is appropriate recognition of the first languages of this country. In saying that, there has to be a recognition that there can also be inappropriate recognition of such languages. Ignoring the reality of such languages, lingua nullius, is problematic enough. But there has also been a cost to sociolinguistic integrity by some of the supposed recognition of the first languages that has happened since 1788. How many Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander words do you know? Just think for a moment. I'm not sure what words are coming into your minds, but it's possible that you may be thinking such words as kangaroo, wallaby, emu, echidna, boomerang, didgeridoo, dingo, koala, goanna, kwandong, yabby, willy willy, yakka, kadaicha, whirly, kui, woomera, nulla nulla, cassowary, cockatoo, and Kylie. And before you think that Kylie Minogue gets herself into everything, I hasten to add that it is thought that the name Kylie comes from the Noongar word for throwing stick. But coming back to the words I've just listed, and you doubtless thought of more, there are some problems that arise from the commonality of such words. Firstly, a number of them were never from Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander languages in the first place. Cockatoo and cassowary come from Malay, while echidna comes from Greek, and goanna is a simplification of a Latin American word. In a similar vein, didgeridoo is said to have been coined by early colonists out of a combination of its onomatopoeic-like quality and the Scots Gaelic for black piper. But a more serious problem is that of the 17 remaining words in the list above that are of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander etymology, seven of them came from one language alone, Darug, that which was spoken in the area where Sydney now sits. In other words, the Aboriginal language that was first encountered by the first colonists has had a disproportionate impact on the number of first language words we, across the country, have taken into Australian English on the belief that they are from Aboriginal languages. For the record, those words are kui, corroboree, dingo, koala, nulla nulla, wallaby, and woomera from the list I gave. The significance of the problem here is that other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island languages have not only had to face the powerful linguistic assault of English, they've also had to cope with the imposition on their own lexicons of alien words from other totally different first language lexicons. To get just a taste of what I'm trying to say, imagine if Chinggis Khan and his band of merry men had occupied all of Europe in the 12th and 13th centuries, including the birthplace of English, and had applied some local words that they may first have encountered as they crossed from the eastern part of Europe across to the west, crossing into Hungary, for example. Subsequent generations of Mongol colonists living in Britain may have felt they were using local indigenous words when they said such things as imadat and shatatas when describing our religious practices of worship and ritual. Or they may have called our spears lanza, all words that would in fact have been meaningless to locals. Incidentally, by the way, in that early list of words I gave, only one of them came from Ghana, Wurli, coming from Wadley. On a related matter of problems of imposed words is that of foreign language descriptions of autochthonous practices. I think I was about 7 or 8 when I first heard of the concept of an untranslatable word. We'd been watching a documentary at school on the Netherlands and its canals, and at some point the narrator mentioned a Dutch word that he said was untranslatable into English. And you can look at the website to see what that word was. I'm sure you may be able to think of words that are untranslatable. The Scottish word canny, for example. What happens in such situations is that often the foreign word is simply brought into English. On other occasions, a best fit is concocted from within the English lexicon. And this has been the case with two words in Australian English, dreamtime and walkabout. The website, creativespirits.info, has a particularly interesting entry about the word preferred to the word dreamtime, namely dreaming. The reason for the change from earlier practice is expressed on that site by Carl Telfer, who wrote, "We are the oldest and the strongest people. We're here all of the time. We're constant through the dreaming, which is happening now. There is no such thing as dreamtime." What Carl Telfer describes is a translation chasm between two cultures. The now predominant culture sought to compartmentalize a spirituality with a notion of archaism, of a time gone, of a time lost. When in fact the culture that generated this particular spirituality consciously chose to remove it from the realm of time and hence keep its currency. For the record, that same website contains a number of other words that are used in Aboriginal languages for such spirituality and beliefs. For example, the Pichinjara Chakurpa. The same website on another page says of the word walkabout that it is a derogatory term used when someone doesn't turn up or is late. Because of this, it also states its use by non-Aboriginal people is considered inappropriate. And it notes that groups such as Reconciliation Queensland advise against its use when discussing Aboriginal culture. Nicole Tidgen, Advocacy Manager of Tourism SA, has this to say about the real concept that lies behind walkabout. An Aboriginal person who is on walkabout connects with their spiritual obligations by tracing the paths formed by their ancestors at the beginning of time. In the process, important information is encrypted in songs and ceremony that have led to the concept of songlines. Where we have historically chosen not to impose a seeming close-fit English word for an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander word, phrase or concept, the tendency has been to impose a word from only one of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages, and I mentioned that before with respect to Darug. A case in point is the word corroboree. Again, referring to Creative Spirits Info website, it notes the wide variety of words used by different languages, such as Inma in Pichinjara, Palti in Ghana, Nakawalan in Narangeri, and Guribunguru in Naranga. Since we are now talking about matters of faith, spirituality and ritual, and again, don't worry, this is not going to turn into a sermon despite my relatively recently gained title, let me turn my attention to churches. The churches have played a significant role in what has happened to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages. In South Australia, the first recorded use of an Aboriginal language by a non-Aboriginal person seems to have taken place on May the 25th in 1839. when Reverend Sherman read the Ten Commandments to those Kaurna assembled as part of the Queen's birthday festivities. The impacts of churches on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages have reflected the tension of the theological dialectic in the Bible between the Tower of Babel in the Old Testament and the Feast of Pentecost in the New Testament. Symptomatic of this division had been the long-standing monolingualism of the Western Church, which contrasted with the multilingualism of the Eastern Church. While local vernaculars reigned in the Eastern Church, Rome's fear of a repeat of the linguistic chaos that followed in the wake of that major infrastructure project, the Tower of Babel, led to the linguistic hegemony of Latin. When it has been at its best, the Church in Australia has sought to echo the spirit of Pentecost in Acts 2:4. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit enabled them. In 1969, the Bible Society completed a project of some decades with the printing of a New Testament in Pitjantjatjara. The project had actually started in the 1930s. This is that Bible's version of that verse. Kachanala chalnagarangu kurumpa mil milnga kayatya kucha pu kuchapat chutangu wankangi kuruntu nintanyanka. My apologies. There have been many Bible translation endeavours over the last couple of centuries, a notable one being the 1864 Scriptural Selections in Narangeri, which was the first part of the Bible published in any of Australia's first languages. The result was that some early missionaries sought to nourish first languages in schools for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and we have here the excellent example in South Australia of Teichelman and Sherman, who were actually teaching in Kaurna in schools. And the letters that were found by the students written in Kaurna to those who had been supporting the school back in Germany, recently rediscovered, have been testimony to that. But while such a sociolinguistic enlightenment was occurring in part of South Australia, it was matched by other more oppressive educational approaches. We're here tonight in the Bonython Hall at Adelaide University. Thank you, Vice-Chancellor. An historic South Australian institution that was given a much more enlightened start than was the case with other Australian universities, and in no small part that was due to the first Anglican Bishop of Adelaide, Augustus Short, who can justifiably take a bow for the leading role he played in giving us such an advanced university for its time. Yet, it would be this very same man who would encourage a type of schooling to which Aboriginal, and I quote, children could go where they could be away from tribal life. Michael Whiting, in his book Augustus Short and the Founding of the University of Adelaide, notes that the aim of such schooling, in the opinion of Bishop Short and his supporters, was so that children would become self-sufficient and employable, and that society would be enhanced by socialising Indigenous people into English collective values. In a letter he wrote in 1848, he wrote, "In the process of civilization, the first effort must be to detach the young natives from connection with native customs and influences." Interestingly, such a process of intentional alienation from cultural roots was at odds with the aspirations of the British at the time of establishing the colony. The Order in Council, signed by King William IV on the 23rd of February 1836, contained this statement: "Nothing therein contained shall affect or be construed to affect the rights of any Aboriginal natives of the said province to the actual occupation or enjoyment in their own persons or in the persons of their descendants of any lands therein now actually occupied." That some of the early settlers understood that statement, such as this, implied more than mere land tenure, but the right to have social continuity, which would include language. This is evidenced by a letter written in 1840 by Matthew Morehouse, again to the Colonial Secretary, and he wrote in part, "The language of the Aborigines has not been overlooked, nor its importance forgotten." Incidentally, a particular interest in Morehouse's letter is a further statement indicative of his appreciation of the power of language to be a repository of knowledge that could easily be lost. He wrote this: "A more extended knowledge of the language has introduced us," that's the colonists, "to a more general acquaintance with the manners and customs of these people. We find what the Europeans thought the Aborigines of Australia did not possess: territorial rights, families owning and holding certain districts of land which passed from fathers to sons. They did possess. They could go further than this, occasionally one family bartering with another. So we had some schools that were teaching in Ghana and some schools that were deliberately moving away from that. Schools clearly remain a very important part of the future sustainability of currently spoken languages and the revival of those that have fallen asleep. But sometimes those schools have had checkered histories in terms of their support or otherwise of local languages. If you go to their website, Raukan Aboriginal School today proudly proclaims, "Nani yan yunti inani, together we can do it." And the school's most recent annual report notes that Narangeri is taught at the school, and also that the home language of students is a form of Aboriginal English which contains some Narangeri vocabulary. The Raukan community, as I mentioned earlier, was the place where the first undertaking of a translation of portions of the Bible occurred in 1864. Yet later, by that annual report's also admission, there would be a long period when the use of Narangeri language was forbidden in the school. I had first visited the APY lands in 1880 when my wife and I responded to an invitation from the principal of Freegon School to go there. It was the first contact that I had with the issue of language maintenance in the APY lands. I was able to see firsthand the two-phase bilingual program in the school, the first phase having English as the second to the local language in cross-curriculum teaching for the first years of primary school, followed by the reversal in the later years of primary school. The concept of bilingual education very much appealed to me, and when I would, just a few months later, be appointed Shadow Minister of Education, I considered ways in which I could promote such a positive idea both in the lands and elsewhere in education. At that time, there was indeed another type of bilingual education, Italian and English, being piloted in two eastern suburbs primary schools in Adelaide. At the time, bilingual education was a concept with considerable cachet, and it would ultimately cease in both locations for entirely different reasons. The Italian-English experiment in the eastern suburbs wound down for the want of students from an L1 Italian setting. The experiment in the APY clearly did not have, and still does not have, a want of students from the first language setting. Bilingual education is a concept whereby the curriculum is conveyed to students in two languages. The curriculum being more than just the teaching of core language competency in either of them, but the use of those languages for the teaching of other disciplines, such as science, mathematics, social studies, and the like. Bilingual programs have an intent to enable students to complete their education with high levels of competency in both languages. Were these two South Australian programs achieving their objectives? In the case of the Italian-English bilingual program, the answer is broadly yes. However, with respect to the Pitjantjatjara English bilingual programs, it can only be noted that particularly vocal concern by elders at Kenmore Park Community resulted in the program ceasing in 1992. It is my contention that they ceased for want of sufficient training of teachers running those programs. The reality was that certainly for most of the 1980s, these programs were being taught by teachers who could not speak Pitjantjatjara. For classroom learning to proceed, these teachers had to rely on Aboriginal education workers as the linguistic go-between with the students. Now, of course, in Pitjantjatjara was introduced in 1985 to give prospective teachers some conversational skill, and the materials were updated from cassette first to CD version later. The provision of such courses was good. However, the fault, in my retrospective opinion, is that any teacher going to teach in the APY lands should have been required to undertake a 3-month intensive course in the language before being posted to the lands. In 1984, another initiative was undertaken by what was then SACAI, now University of South Australia, in the introduction of a 2-year modified teacher training program known as the Anangu Teacher Education Program. Those who completed the 2 years were able to go on to a 3rd year that would enable them to teach anywhere in the state. Over the intervening 30-plus years, some 50 students graduated with a Diploma of Education, Anangu Education, the 2-year program, and 25 with a Bachelor of Education. There has been some suggestion the program might not continue, but I understand from news tonight that it hopefully will. But the point I want to make here is that with these increasing number of teachers capable of speaking Pitjantjatjara and of being able to teach, then this would provide the necessary bilingual education capacity, and it was the absence of that which killed off the program in 1992. At this point, it would be worthwhile my making some comments on my involvement in the establishment of the Ghana Plains School. Dr. Alicia Rigney has in other fora very graciously commented on the contributions she believes I made to assisting the rejuvenation of the Ghana language by my support for the establishment of that school, and I thank her for those comments. It is certainly true that I strongly supported the establishment of the school back in 1985 in the face of significant opposition from elements of the local non-Aboriginal community. And Peter Buxkin knows, because he was well and truly involved with me. We were colleagues at the time. There was even the suggestion put directly to me at the time that were a no confidence vote to be moved against me in the House of Assembly, and given the government's minority status, that I could have lost my ministerial position. What we now know is the Ghana Plains School was originally called the Elizabeth Urban Aboriginal School. And in the report in December 1985, the Parliamentary Public Works Standing Committee noted the three, amongst other aims, three key aims: to maintain and reinforce the feelings, knowledge and understanding of Aboriginality in order to develop pride, confidence and self-esteem as Aboriginal people, and to provide students with the skills necessary for the interaction in their own community and the wider Australian community, and to involve the Aboriginal community in the responsibility for education in order that a familiar and positive learning environment be provided for Aboriginal students. And in talking about those three aims, proposed a number of means, two of which were, teaching an Aboriginal language and using Aboriginal English patterns in early literacy experience, and while introducing the use of standard English, never doing so in a way that devalues the first language. In the end, the Parliamentary Committee decided to recommend that the school should go ahead. I had been, in the context of the opposition, accused of introducing apartheid into our education system and of wanting to limit exposure to Aboriginal studies in the education system by limiting the discipline to this school and other primarily Aboriginal schools. I gave a long statement to the committee, too long to quote here, but perhaps I might quote this one statement. All I ask is for members of the community to give this their fullest consideration, a fair consideration, and look at the examples we now have in South Australia, where Aboriginal education is following various models, proving themselves successful for the students within them. The school was established, and in 1992 would commence Ghana teaching. And that has been a very significant development in the revitalisation of the Ghana language. And Jack Buxkin particularly has made a number of very powerful comments upon his own engagement with that. This brings to the issue of what should our education system be doing. Well, first of all, proper resourcing. I've talked about teacher training. There also needs to be material production. There needs to be the reintroduction of strong, well-resourced bilingual programs in schools where there's a majority Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population. But in communities where the numbers are not in the majority, but nevertheless significant, there should be compulsory second language teaching provided to all students. And in all other communities, teaching of local or regional languages should be encouraged as subjects and certainly promoted as modules of study within other subjects. Turning to the subject of the status of language. Noel Pearson, back in 2012, promoted the idea that the expert panel on constitutional recognition of Indigenous Australians should include a reference to language in the proposals for amending the Constitution. And as a result, a draft clause, 127A, was put out for discussion. That clause read, "The national language of the Commonwealth of Australia is English. The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages are the original Australian languages, a part of our national heritage." Now, Pearson himself acknowledges that it has largely disappeared from the national discourse about constitutional recognition. It will therefore most probably not be included in the recognised referendum to be held next year. And I can agree that there are sound reasons for that, but this should not stop the issue of legal recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages being dealt with in other ways than by amendment to the Constitution. In other words, to examine alternative ways of giving the status of officiality to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages. English is not, by constitutional proclamation, the official language of Australia. Rather, its preeminent status has come about through a quasi-constitutionalism resulting from state practice since the first exercise of colonial government in 1788. All federal, state, and territory statute law and regulations are composed in English. All court judgments are composed in English. In Australia, English has not needed constitutional sanction to shore up this preeminent status. So if English could not only survive and thrive without such a sanction, one could well ask why would other languages need some form of officiality? Again, quoting Gillard Zuckerman, he has previously pointed out that New Zealand has two official languages. If you haven't heard him speak on the subject, I almost certainly know what you're now thinking. You're thinking that the two official languages of New Zealand must be English and Te Reo Māori, and you'd be only half right. Te Reo Māori is certainly an official language of New Zealand, but the other official language is New Zealand's sign language. English has no status of officiality in New Zealand. Te Reo Māori gained it in 1987 and NZSL in 2006. Both achieve such status through statute law, not through constitutional amendment. The same could be done in this country. But to do so would require an acknowledgement of an element of primacy being given to the autochthonous languages of this country, the first languages, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages. There are some in this country who might reject that. In commenting on the use of Walpiri by Bess Price that I referred to at the beginning of my speech, Bob Gosford, writing for Crikey.com, had this to say. There are very real practical issues to do with the provision of interpreters to those members in the NT Assembly who may choose to use a language other than English. Two of the members are of Dutch descent, while two others are of Italian and Indian heritage, and they may wish to use their first language. In other words, he is presuming an absolute equality amongst all languages other than English languages in this country. But why should that be so? Why in this one area should it be inconceivable that Australia's first languages not have primacy over all others? Not only for the sake of an historical recognition that this land was not lingua nullius at first colonial settlement, but also because Bess Price's point had been to be able to communicate the feelings of some of her constituents, Australian-born people, who did not have fluency or proficiency in English. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages are autochthonous. They exist nowhere else on the planet. If they are not to be protected here, then they will be protected nowhere else, other than perhaps in the aspect quality of museum files. But I return to the point in dealing with the merits or otherwise of official status being given to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages. Amongst the issues worth considering are the status of such languages in the courts of law. And I'm somewhat conscious, very conscious, of being in the presence of so many Supreme Court justices and masters who doubtless will grab me later with their legal opinions. Unlike some other countries that have human rights charters that enshrine the right of a plaintiff to interpretation, Australia has relied on its being a signatory to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and in particular, in terms of tonight's topic regarding this defined right, I quote, "the right to the free assistance of an interpreter if the person cannot understand or speak the language used in court." The history of the de facto existence of such a right, certainly before the covenant, is mixed. In a very interesting paper entitled Ngalulu Nuranya Putu Kulini, The Legal Right to an Interpreter, presented to the Language and Law Conference in 2012 by Russell Goldflam, he noted a judicial finding in 1885 in Queensland, where four Aboriginal men were acquitted of a murder charge, and I quote, "because no interpreter could be found to enable them to hear and understand what they had been charged with." Goldflam's use of the phrase "hear and understand" was more than casual, As earlier in his presentation, he had noted how in both Pitjantjatjara and Arantha, a single word conveyed the meaning, both hearing and understanding. Kulini in the former, Awame in the latter. And he used this duality to make the point that the accused must both be able to hear and to understand. He further used his presentation to examine the international covenant acknowledged by Australia, alongside his insertion that in Australian law, the judge has a final discretion whether to allow interpreter or not. Whilst he did note that such discretion must be properly exercised and would be highly susceptible to a successful appeal in the event of a failure to provide interpretation, he also highlighted the danger of ambiguity in such an uncertain situation, and he cited a 1999 statement by the then Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, who said, "Providing Aborigines with interpreters is like giving a wheelchair to someone who should be walking." The 1986 report of the Australian Legal Rights Commission, Report 31, included two quotes that spoke into the hearing and understanding dilemma, as it particularly applied to those Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders for whom English was not their first language. The report quoted Justice Kreerot's comments about a situation that applied in the 1950s. In the Northern Territory, the trial of an Aborigine in most cases proceeds, as far as I could gather, has always proceeded, as if the accused were not present. If he were physically absent, no one would notice this fact. The accused, so far as I could judge, in most cases takes no interest in the proceedings. He certainly does not understand that portion of the evidence which is of the greatest importance in most cases, namely the account a police constable gives of the confession supposed to have been made by the accused. No attempt is made to translate any of the evidence. He's talking about the 1950s. And in another place, the report cited a comment made in 1981 by the Central Australian Aboriginal Legal Aid Service. "The new and impressive court building in Alice Springs announces the fact that interpreters on request can be obtained on request in about 9 languages, including 2 Chinese dialects." A notable omission in this Alice Springs court is any reference whatsoever to any Aboriginal language, despite the fact that 80%, 60 to 70% of all defendants in the summary courts in Alice Springs and virtually all the defendants in bush courts and as much as 90% of matters listed covered such people. Another area is toponymy. Toponymy is a sometimes underrated aspect of language recognition and respect. Toponymy, or place names matter. If they didn't matter, every place would simply be given a number. And as it is, there is only one place in the whole of Australia whose place name is a number. That's the town of 1770, written as numbers, which is in Queensland. And in case you're interested, 1770 has a postcode of 4677. So if place names matter, so does the language that is used to name them. I'm pleased that it was my government back in 1993 that accepted guidelines by which both Aboriginal names and English names could be given a place. In 1999, indeed, the successor government incorporated those names into the Geographical Names Board legislation. By the way, that board was itself only incorporated in statute in 1969. It had been set up in 1916 when it was called the Nomenclature Committee, which had been set up for the ethnic cleansing of German place names from the South Australian map. But I digress. Surprisingly, place naming can generate strong feelings. Back in October 2010, a contributor to Andrew Bolt's blog on Uluru, and I confess I sometimes look at his blogs just to get myself irritated, posted this comment concerning another contributor named Jim, who had defended the renaming of Ayers Rock as Uluru. He wrote, this is the person attacking Jim, "I still call it Ayers Rock, Jimbo. Also the Grampians, which is the white fella's name. Even still call Footscray Road, well, Footscray Road. Not that Birralong thingy that was foisted upon us. Just because someone changes names doesn't mean we all have to fall into line and like it, or even use these new names." Apart from his transparent bigotry, the correspondent put forward a deeply flawed proposition. Ayers Rock, the Grampians, and Footscray Road were all changes to names. Well, perhaps not Footscray Road, as that was a post-colonial construction. The reality is that names are overwhelmingly arbitrary, at least those that are in English in Australia. On the other hand, Aboriginal place names always had, historically, or if given later, currently, a connection to context. So Onkaparinga came from Nankaparinga, meaning woman's river. As an indicator of the arbitrariness of English language names, Colonel William Light chose in 1836 to propose the name of the central square, the Great Square. A year later, on the 23rd of May, 1837, the town elders chose to rename it after Princess Victoria. So it became Victoria Square. Entirely arbitrary, as Victoria hadn't done anything to merit the honour, she wasn't even queen by that stage, and the space isn't even a square, it's a rectangle. Much less arbitrary, therefore, was a proclamation 165 years later, and again I acknowledge particularly Georgina and Uncle Lewis and others, to change the name officially to Tandanyanga, Victoria Square. Tandanyanga, place of red kangaroo dreaming, having a connection with the general area now covered by the CBD and parklands. By the way, I should note that at the same time there was another alternative proposed for Victoria Square by Rob Amory and Georgina, namely Nyamatia. Toponymy might be considered tokenistic by some. On the other hand, it is emblematic. An effort should be made to extend the dual naming not just of geographical features, but also human constructs such as streets and suburbs. That being said, of course, there are two issues that should be noted. Firstly, the potential for loss of exclusivity of use, which is, I know, a concern amongst Aboriginal communities. And secondly, the question of whether one or other should have primacy. And there's been some reference to that happening in New Zealand. Penultimately, I want to talk about the expansion of genres and domains. If languages remain limited to certain areas of local community, remain limited to their own exposure in those communities, then the danger is that people will choose not to use them. Therefore, there needs to be a conscious effort to expand the opportunity. Granting official status is one way of doing that. But there are many other ways that can also be doing that. Windows is now available in a number of languages. And amongst the Windows 10 languages that you can have your whole system talk to you back in is Cherokee, Quechua from Bolivia, and Kichi from Guatemala. There is no other First Nation language mentioned. But it would be a thought to consider to encourage, given the relatively high rate of computer usage in schools, including Aboriginal schools in our state, to see if those languages could be involved in the Windows 10. Likewise, in media generally, in 1986, I gave evidence before the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal meeting in Alice Springs, indicating that the South Australian government was prepared to put up a $1 million guarantee and purchase airtime on a new TV station, provided it would be the one that would be based out of Alice Springs, which of course became the Imparge network. And that Imparge television, our vision was, would provide an opportunity not only for media to go into all the communities out there, but also the opportunity for languages to be communicated in that. The internet. I have studied the Asturian language and was very interested to note that it and many other small languages, under threat from dominant languages, have very often been able to find internet usage, their websites in their own language, as a means of communicating against other media blockages. And I note particularly Garnawarra Pintianthi, the work that has been done in KWP, in precisely the same happening here. Finally, there's the production of foreign language materials, and in this context I mean English language materials into First Nation languages. Those languages that are succeeding best in extending the range of usage in both the domains and in the genres are doing some very interesting things in that area. Galician in Spain found that it was able to expand its television audiences by gaining the Spanish rights for the broadcast Spanish rights of a program called Falcon Crest, and you could only watch it if you understood Galician. They also got rights for sporting programs. Now, I mention that because there are all these ways of looking at alternative means of expanding the usage, the willing usage by listeners and viewers of these languages. I started my oration this evening talking about an incident on Australia Day and a performance of our national anthem by Jessica Mowboy. Back in 1993, when I was Premier, I'd raised the suggestion in Executive Council as to whether the opening of Parliament that year could have an element conducted in an Aboriginal language. The formal opening of Parliament is an occasion of pomp and ceremony, all designed to reinforce the authority of a commonweal of people brought together as an institution of state for the benefit of those very people. The then Governor, Dame Roma Mitchell, was sympathetic to the idea, though, with her characteristic sound knowledge of constitutional and statute law, pointed out that such an event would have no legal standing in the opening proceedings and would be akin to the fanfare that was to be played from the Strangers' Gallery of the Assembly. With this semi-green light to proceed, I asked our then Minister of Aboriginal Affairs, Kim Mays, to investigate how best this might be effected. A few weeks later, he reported back that the idea was proving more difficult to progress than initially anticipated, for the very good reason of the multilingual nature of South Australia. Which language or languages would be chosen being key, but not alone amongst the questions raised. Sadly, as time was too short before the opening, and with many other affairs of the busyness of state to preoccupy Cabinet's mind, the idea was laid aside. It is one of my regrets, but as Ned Kelly would say, such is life. However, the principle behind my idea was a recognition of the power of language symbols quite apart from genres and domain of usage or of legal status. Time would come when acknowledgement of country would become more commonplace, but the issue I sought was more integrative, namely a conscious acknowledgement of language equality in the very organs of state. On Anzac Day this year, I attended the dawn service held in Katherine in the Northern Territory. About 1,000 people attended, and I was moved to note that the bi-national nature of the Anzac story was recognised by those present as both Australian and New Zealand national anthems were sung. But at that point, the irony of the situation came into sharp focus as our national anthem was sung monolingually, while New Zealand's God Defend New Zealand, Manakatia Mai Aotearoa, was sung bilingually. There in the top end, with strong representation in the crowd attending the dawn service from local Aboriginal communities, we listened to anthems in English and Maori and no other language. Of course, the excuse the South Australian Cabinet accepted in 93 could well be played again. It would not be possible to have a bilingual Australian anthem. There are simply too many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages. Our anthem would rival AIDA in length if all were to be recognised. The South African national anthem, Nkosi Sikelel' iAfrika, does follow a selective multilingual path with verses from 5 of the country's national languages out of a total 11. But a national anthem with over 100 verses, not realistic. However, I believe there are two solutions that the National Parliament could consider. The first would be authorising of official translations of our anthem into all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander languages spoken in Australia today, with the provision that these official translations could be sung in those geographic areas where each of those languages is autochthonous. Thus, here in Adelaide, a Kaurna version could be sung at the dawn service alongside the English version or at Australia Day ceremonies. Thinking about this possibility, I thought about South Australia's own candidate for the national anthem that had topped the poll in 1977 but came fourth nationally. Carolyn Carlton and Carl Linger's Song of Australia. You know it well, I'm sure. There is a land where summer skies are gleaming with 1,000 eyes, blending in witching harmonies in harmonies, and grassy knoll and forest height are flushing in a rosy light, and all above is Asia bright, Australia. Perhaps our South Australian legislature might consider proclaiming official translations of this would-be anthem as an encouragement to our national parliament. But then another possibility occurred to me. Two anthems. Our existing national anthem could be complemented by another one that would have its provenance from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander inheritance. We have three official flags, And as we South Australians note with pride, the Aboriginal flag designed by Harold Thomas, a Luritja man, first flew in Australia on the 12th of July 1971 in Tandanyanga, Victoria Square, and was finally proclaimed official in 1995, the same date as the Torres Strait Islander flag. A parallel national anthem in multilingual versions would give Australia a richer voice of unity. As I thought about this, I recalled a poem by Eva Johnson called Visions. Eva, of the Malak Malak people in the Daly River, was taken from her mother at the age of 2, first to Croker Island Mission, and then at the age of 10 to an orphanage of Adelaide. The first and last verses of her poem had for me an anthemic ring about them, and so I will finish by reciting them. We cling to our hopes and dreams of another brand new day that mould our lives into sculptures of images wrapped in clay. There is hope in our tomorrows. Our love must show the way. Let our children's words be spoken from visions of yesterday. We keep our own flag flying in colours black, red and gold to remember our living and dying, our history that has never been told. Let the voice of our new generation break the barriers across this land and fight with pride and dignity with the vision we hold in our hand.
Ladies and gentlemen, as is our practice at the oration, we're going to close with two freedom songs. In previous years, students from CASN have performed. This year, Vonda Last, who unfortunately is unwell tonight and is not here, has brought together a collaboration between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander singers and a non-Aboriginal a cappella choir, Hot Gospel, directed by Quentin Ayres. They will sing We Shall Overcome and Freedom. I now invite Bianca, Auntie Loja's great niece, who will take to the stage to start singing. Thank you.
Black and white together.